read two essays which, for me, are pivotal to my thinking and my polemic. I must say I'm very sympathetic to Ed Baxter and Chris Weaver for setting up the University of the Air, because I've always thought that the pleasure of the intellect should not be restricted to those who are paid to do it, i.e. academics, but could be something entertaining for everybody. And in pursuit of this aim, I wrote a book on Frank Zappa a couple of decades ago called The Negative Dialectics of Poodle Play. And what I'd like to read is the postfix to the fourth edition. The book sold okay, so I was allowed to reply to my reviewers, and I wrote a postfix. And the publishers were pleased enough with it. They told me they found it very funny and were definitely going to put it in the fourth edition. For me to say, well, how about a whole book in that vein? And they allowed me to do that. The follow-up to my book on Zappa was called Art, Class and Cleavage, Quantulum Cunque Concerning Materialist Aesthetics, and it hardly sold a copy. This is because it couldn't leapfrog on Frank Zappa's preeminence and fame. But for me, the two books are very connected, and what I'd like to do is, what I'm going to do is read the postfix of the fourth edition, followed by the introduction to Art, Class and Cleavage, and I think you'll see that they are connected. I've opened the window here at Resonance. I think having a little bit of ambient noise is rather pleasant. In fact, that's the reason I prefer going to gigs at Conway Hall to the South Bank. I find the South Bank is completely inoculated against the noises of London, and I think this is rather dull. So the sounds you can hear when I'm pre-record here, when I broadcast from here on a Wednesday, there's generally a school playground happening, which gives me a very pleasant sound of children playing and shouting. It's summer holidays at the moment, so you haven't got that, but you do have a little traffic on Borough High Street. But being early August, the traffic is quite light. Everyone seems to be on holiday. So here it is, the postfix to the fourth edition of Frank Zappa, The Negative Dialectics of Poodle Play. To the present hour, poodle play remains, both in England and the States, an outlandish science. 600 pages were evidently insufficient. Interviews about the book invariably led towards the question, Mr. Watson, can you tell us what exactly is the negative dialectics of poodle play? A supplementary talk at the Institute of Contemporary Art failed to satisfy the media's craving for a quick-fit clue, a definition. You could practically see the pigeonholes arrayed across their think space, the grid of journalistic common sense clamping down like a grim grey waffle iron upon the method's self-defining batter. Polymorphous protoplasm in the area. Only singeing tongs and claptraps need apply. Answers were, naturally, artificially improvised to suit the occasion. The observer was told, poodle play is materialist cultural analysis that refuses to dissolve the intractable doggedness of the vulgar mind in patronising abstractions. It plays with its subject, playing, like psychoanalysis, with the loci of the unconscious, slips of the tongue, dreams, neurosis, puns and inexplicable coincidence, in order to articulate the pleasures of the material, what Howlin' Wolf called hidden charms. Poodle play is the opposite of negative dialectics, which is the exhaustless refutation of the tendency to think that the concept exhausts the thing conceived. Negative dialectics criticises the infantile self-satisfaction of poodle play and its approach to the world via chewed, baby-battered concept rattles, while poodle play revels in the accidents attendant upon trying to give voice to negative dialectics. For the Cambridge Conference of Contemporary Poetry, an antique definition was exhumed from a journal named Heretic. It ran like this. The negative dialectics of poodle play do indeed adorn cultural studies pretty late in the day, but may yet have a dwindle or two to perform in the pygmy twilight that remains. Let it be said, without hesitation, that the method bypasses fold-in, automatic writing, deconstruction, cyber-toss, black sci-fi, and Urban Guerda's Zapata-physics in one fell Marxist swerve, coagulating at the finishing post in Leninist garb. poodle play works from the realisation that until now, philosophers have stuttered, merely domesticating the final term with their slavering servilities of formulation, so that as one may as well go the whole hog and base the theory on a dog. Posit an explicitly cheap absurdity like the poodle as the kingpin of one's dialectic. Poodle play denies breathy profundities of the existentialist ilk and all its structuralist and postmodern varieties. It operates dialectically within its subject matter to articulate a common economic and sexual substructure. It invokes with relish the tawdriest of stunts if these can disappoint the pretensions of the third term, a stunted dialectics hostile to the formation of airy peaks, the dizzying sublimity of the achieved triad. Those who peddle their current brands of certified explanation and wave their little bo-peep diplomas to draw attention to the fact had better watch out. The negative dialectics of poodle play will not mind its own business. Anticipation is so much worse. Cheesy aromas won't be allowed to waft by unremarked. The Toronto-based internet magazine Magnet was told, approaching art in a way that refuses to ignore the social totality was bound to fall foul of those for whom Malcolm X's roosting chickens was simply an opportunity to supplement individual careers with stuffing and gravy. Poodle play's conjuncture between Marxism and the politically incorrect is just what the squeaky clean White House washers of the new imperialism could do without. That's why I wrote it. Of course, launching such a slab at reviewers bred to slurp on the dilute poop of rock bios was bound to produce spluttering indignation. Deadlines loomed and the thing was still unread. Some linguistically challenged hacks resorted to repeating the blurb, boring but good for sales, others to fulsome abuse, more amusing to read, probably good for sales too. The book was not popular among the IPC roster. Vox resorted to the eerily familiar charge of self-indulgence. Dense, closely argued and academically rigorous, here is a monolithic work of formidable scholarship, if quite spectacular, self-indulgence. Self-indulgence remained the ultimate put-down, despite the fact that the book repeatedly points out how the term was coined by the industry to condemn music that doesn't flatter a critic's role as purveyor of chart fodder. The ideological import of self-indulgence is attacked on pages 65, 161, 354, 402 and 492. Defend your pathetic strip of the commercial demesne by all means, gentlemen, but at least get hip to the brickbats being thrown your way. Harold Wilson was proud to find Capital unreadable, and sad to say the same attitude now characterises the critique nouvelle of pop journalism. Q magazine opined, purchasers should not underestimate the density or relative obscurity of some of the writing. Density! Relative obscurity! How could Q fail to recognise that poodle play, strangely like the aforementioned Capital in fact, was custom designed to reach its thinking Marxist proletarian target, sloughing off demagogic consumerist glamour like so much dandruff. The gaping schisms of modern society, its sordid paradoxes and ersatz self-justifications, its celebration in print of incapacity to deal with print, became more depressingly evident as further reviews puked their sorry load on my doormat. Despite stripping me of my clothes and placing me on a toilet, not so much unplugged as unplumbed, the quality press still felt they hadn't got to the bottom of poodle play. Journalists obviously can only trust the naysaying of the dialectic direct from the horse's mouth. The Observer followed up their hour's worth of nude interrogation with an anguished phone call. Sorry, but can you run the idea of the book's title past me again? Direct Access did not prevent them dreaming up a non-existent Zappa album called Fido and spelling Adorno's first name Theodore with an E on the end. They had this in common with the Zappa fanzine Tamershi Duin, but this is written by self-confessed illiterates. Like being truncheoned by a policeman, if somewhat less painful, 15 minutes of media fame reveals that normality is a farce. We are daily being protected and informed by criminal incompetence, environed by quasi-factual monstrosities. Poodle play, poised between megalomania and bathos, a mean streak of cut-glass honesty in the midst of the potato peelings, is forever going to be rubbished by the forces of media seriousness as they trivialise the price of cereals and hypothesise the latest transcendent muesli. At the Sunday Times, Mark Edwards fell into line, evidently piqued at being pipped to the post in applying Frankfurt School theory to trash. Next week he was quoting Adorno in an article on Steptoe and Son. Edwards resolved to try out some contradictions of his own devise. He said, "Unfortunately, Watson could only bring high culture critical theory to bear on Zappa's work and it doesn't fit." Later on he said, "If you find yourself instinctively following Watson's rock lineage quest, looking for links between Zappa and Prince, this is the book for you." Undecided whether he's reading Telos Journal or Mojo magazine, Edwards vented his frustrations in personal abuse and selective quotation. Zappa's comment that he himself hadn't read right through any books by James Joyce became proof that the idea of Zappology becoming the next Joyce industry is ridiculous. Edwards, of course, omits Zappa's next remark, which recorded his impression of Joyce gleaned from reading a few pages of Ulysses. "Now there's a real guy." The painful ambiguity of Zappa's relationship to Poodle Play, that hallucinogenic real-life staging of the encounter between body and mind, actuality and idea, object and theory, recounted in my epilogue, was reduced to a personal attack on a poor, pathetic, star-struck author. "That's the point of the whole book, you numbskulls. Does theory work? Is fan consumption a fantasy? Can anyone talk to anyone else in the modern world?" Not questions the Sunday Times wishes to broach, evidently. As expected, the high-low cultural question provoked the most vitriol, snooty drivel raining down in torrents of pucous mucus. Jazz and rock have managed to squat the music story as a site for a culture improvised from below. So it was the outrage of Poodle Play's literary treatment of Zappa that became the repugnant hot potato. As last bastion guarantee of hierarchical value, literature still rules the roost in journalism, whatever the claims of postmodernism in the academy. In order to demonstrate how hopelessly unsuitable for serious analysis is Zappa's music, and no doubt provoke a righteous round of disapproving, Mark Edwards quoted these lines from Zappa's Easy Meat. "Saw her tiny titties through her see-through blouse, I just had to get that girl to my house." According to Edwards, it is pure invention for Poodle Play to argue that such expressions of lust might constitute a criticism of transcendent values that set you apart from the mass. Zappa's disclaimers at being treated as great art, actually a sign of his Dada materialism, are quoted as further proof of the failure of Poodle Play. The hierarchical cretinism of educational snobbery prevented the quality press from entertaining the idea that even if Zappa hated James Joyce, Theodore Adorno, Samuel Taylor Coleridge and William Shakespeare, every last high cultural totem raided by Poodle Play, he might still draw similar parallelograms in the sand. "What are you protecting, you whinging agents of rarefied value and unread classics?" Hard to fathom that such trivial prestige as writing on the arts page in a broadsheet can be deemed sufficient reward for defending the indefensible rigmarole of class society. Curiously enough, these words from Easy Meat find their precise equivalent in Chapter 13 of Ulysses, where Bloom jerks himself off whilst ogling young Gertie McDowell. She coyly exposes her thighs to his gaze while leaning back to admire fireworks in the sky. "And her face was suffused with a divine and entrancing blush from straining back, and you could see her other things too, nainsook knickers, the fabric that caresses the skin, better than those other petty wits, the green 4 and 11 on account of being white, and she let him, and she saw that he saw, and then it went out of sight a moment, and she was trembling in every limb from being bent so far back. He had full view, high above her knee, no one ever, not even on the swing or wading, and she wasn't ashamed, and he wasn't either, to look in that immodest way like that, because he couldn't resist the sight of the wondrous revealment, half offered like those skirt dancers, behaving so immodest before gentlemen looking, and he kept on looking, looking." Bloom, with careful hand, recomposed his wet shirt. "The divine blush! Don't get no jizz on the maroon sofa, Leopold. In the feuilleton sections of the bourgeois press, literature is transformed into a mantel shelf ersatz, the conflicts and tensions that produced it buffed to a memory screening sheen. Edwards genuflects at the shrine of Joyce the great writer, but he's obviously forgotten what Ulysses actually contains. Frank Zappa took music as far as 20th century art could go, but refused the heavenly stare to the übermensch mezzanine proffered by the bourgeoisie. Edwards, in fact, on Easy Meat, is just a rerun of Rebecca West sniffing at a Joyce poem in order to denigrate Ulysses, though he is even less capable than she of gauging artistic monumentality. As long as the British ruling class holds sway, we are saddled with Bloomsbury and its jodhpur ways. Next week, a Charles Murray wrote in to complain, calling Edwards' review appallingly condescending. It was certainly a textbook example of pseudo-literary snobbery masquerading as music writing. The New York Times, too, balked at these comparisons to Joyce. Don't piss on the Buddha, mum. New York Times said, a wordsmith on a par with James Joyce and a philosopher on a par with Theodore Adorno, even the most devoted fan must find this sort of thing a bit much. The bourgeois obsession with value, rewards, dividends, who's boss, becomes here simply a block to comprehension. This review was by Peter Keepnews, whose father Orrin produced Thelonious Monk, as well as writing useful jazz criticism. My contention was always that Zappa's entire oeuvre constitutes an entity that gives similar scope for speculation as Finnegan's Wake. It was the incongruity of the coincidences between Adorno's formulations and Zappa's art that gave a poodle play its kick. Zappa's aesthetic integrity must be giving us real information about society, because otherwise the surfeit of coincidence is simply too great to fathom. Keepnews and his hidebound notions of great men recalls the 19th century shopkeeper mentality that can only respond to the murder of a head teacher outside his school by suggesting he be given a posthumous medal. This was a real story on talk radio in 1995. Actually, this is going to be edited a little bit afterwards, but I suggest you leave these bits of word frothage in just to give people a slight relief from the relentless conceptual bombardment of the text. Keepnews quotes Zappa saying his lyrics are for entertainment purposes only, as if that ruled them out of court for any serious analysis. Did Monk Thelonious? How did I turn? This is getting very bad. My reading is getting very confused, but I think we should leave this all in. Kind editors listening to this on headphones at Resonance at some early hour in the morning. Did Monk dance around his piano for nothing, man? Does Keepnews ever ponder his own dreams or slips of tongue? Or does he believe that unconscious creativity is a paltry thing to investigate? The misapprehension of the relationship between art and life in bourgeois society, a result of the topsy-turvy tension between dead labour, capital and living labour, us, stamps its deadliness in every corner. Geniuses and stars are the pillars of salt hierarchical society erects on the waste ground of our ruined lives. Kick down the statues! Live out your dreams! To his credit, in a field fenced over by moralism and ersatz sociology, Keepnews did voice some concern about music. However, the disastrous effects of a formal music education were all too evident. He regrets Poodleplay's use of adjectives. He quotes, strained and scraping, knotted and boiling, which sound like a vivid evocation of Keepnews' own ressentiment to us, and notes that Poodleplay can tell us who influenced Zappa, but not how. Here is a man itching with his own specialised expertise, annoyed that the book isn't talking his key signatures and bar lines. Go and write the thing yourself, and I'd be glad to read it. The local press in Yorkshire provided some light relief. The Yorkshire Evening Post called the book very pretentiously titled and claimed it was a cash-in on Zappa's death. A bizarre interview in my front room for Yorkshire Post resulted in such febrile fantasies as, to his close circle of friends, Ben Watson is an intellectual giant, a maverick pioneer, and a fanatical Marxist. It's funny when people say things like that, isn't it? I mean, I've only ever been criticised and attacked by all my friends. That's what they're for. This idea of a little circle of people all worshipping you is a fantasy by outsiders always. And carry on with the Yorkshire Post. To a less knowing audience, he may seem pretentious and arrogant, airily dismissive of those who claim his writing is unintelligible and self-indulgent. Ah, that word again. While Watson's literary style can seem forbidding, the man himself is affable and engaging. His lifestyle is simple, abstemious even. I like that. Quotes appear around bizarre misconstructions of history I could never have uttered. Factual distortions thrust in the mouth, swallowing mutant swordfish in a dream. Yorkshire Post went on. Watson then flirted with punk before joining the Socialist Workers' Party. And they quote me, "When I was at Cambridge, some of the most exciting academics were members of the SWP, and intellectually Marxism appealed to me, but I learnt that their politics was very distorted because they didn't live it." Now, in the mid-70s, Cambridge SWP did not have any student members from the university, let alone any dons. It was the inability of Communist Party and Labour Party academics to relate to any politics beyond the nursery action group that led to my interest in the SWP. The intellectual delights of post-Althusserian structuralism seemed meagre indeed, coming from the mouths of radical intellectuals who seemed to have no idea about what to do about the National Front. For its part, Yorkshire Post did the delightful service of printing the name of the street in Leeds where I lived. During the summer months of 1994, Combat 18 thugs were regularly skulking around our Saturday Socialist Worker paper sales in attempts to intimidate us. Having my address in the local paper didn't appear a good idea. No, that bunch of Nazis was not looking for my autograph mark. You begin to see why pop stars take drugs. The normality provided by the newspapers is so twisted and weird, you need a quick way out. Radio, I'm afraid, was the worst. Of course, DJs hate Zappa. His music is custom designed to land them in trouble. Someone prepared to talk about him must be equally repulsive. According to the holy principle of commercial radio, which says you must not play or say anything, as hasn't been heard 100 times before, the goon on Greater London Radio, GLR, was disturbed by the book's arcane references. Peter Curran said, "With all these references to Igor Stravinsky and so on, the book assumes an awful lot for the casual reader, that they will be as well-read as you are, Ben." When I replied that I'd constructed a detailed index so that people who didn't like finishing books, like Zappa himself, could find the topic they wanted, the DJ could hardly contain himself. "I'm sure they'll be glad to hear your patronising tones coming over the speakers. You don't read nothing in books if you're a Frank Zappa fan. What do? Chew the legs of chairs of whatever institution that they're in?" I replied, "They listen to music. You must remember that Frank Zappa was always the master of the wind-up, and maybe we're pursuing that particular route here." Peter Curran replied, "I don't know, I think you're dancing a bit fast here trying to put your book over a 600-page wind-up, I doubt it. Tell us a bit about Zappa's music. I sometimes enjoy it, but other times I think, you self-indulgent pig," that word again, "sitting up there on stage and just showing off your dexterity. You just can't communicate with anyone else. And then with songs like Titties and Beer, he's trying to have his cake and eat it, isn't he?" And the interview included a direct exchange on the dreaded self-indulgence topic. I said, "People call Zappa self-indulgent, but if you look at it technically, there's an incredible amount of work, little snippets of this and that, little details. It's all very carefully put together." Peter Curran, "But that's what self-indulgence is, isn't it? Lots and lots of detailed bit." Me, "Well, I've always said, if you can't indulge yourself, then who can you indulge?" Peter Curran, choked laugh, "Well, what about the idea he was a total technocrat, indeed autocrat, in the studio he laid down the law for his players? Later on, he became very serious, not to say pretentious, with running for president and so on, didn't he?" Non-commercial radio produced further grotesques. Poodle Play was brought in to supply light relief after a report on Vanessa Redgrave performing some bleeding heart art surgery in Sarajevo. The presumption of bourgeois art forms knows no bounds. And Malcolm Bradbury speaking about Anglo-American relations. The smiley face on the clown turned upside down, and out came the iron frankfurter of negative dialectics. Lisa Jardine, gaily, "Ben, why should we go on caring about Zappa's music?" Out to lunch, professorially, "I think because it's vast, because it addresses many of the issues we've been talking about here very acutely. I'd take issue with Malcolm when he said that America saved Europe after the Second World War. I think that's quite a right-wing way of looking at things. It seems to think that fascism or capitalism are the only possible orders. I'd pick Frank Zappa as someone who pursued themes in European art that were exactly swamped by the victory of America in terms of a radical revolutionary modernism. Of course, it's refracted through the fact that he could only realise his art through very commercial machinery. Therefore, it's not taken seriously by people in colleges who study novels and so on, because it's pop music. But I think his musical modernism actually developed themes of a new art that came to exist in the early part of this century in Europe that hadn't been seen elsewhere. That was what my excitement with Zappa originally was, finding someone who could deliver avant-garde art using commercial means. Lisa Jardine, also somewhat professorially. I think you're on sticky ground about professors not listening to Frank Zappa, because here you are on this programme and here we are listening to Zappa. But isn't there a problem of being over-solemn about someone who bridges low and high culture? I don't want it to sound like Christopher Ricks on Bob Dylan. Zappa is an extraordinary person who moves through the outrageous and weird and popular through the avant-garde, boulez, classical high art music. But I want you to give some sense of how Zappa's influence will continue to be felt without us getting ponderously into Marx and Adorno, the things professors talk about. Lunch, still more professorially. It's a technical understanding of what commercial art can deliver that excites me. In some ways, Don't Eat the Yellow Snow sounds exactly like an ad. Ads are frequently the most interesting part of television in the technical sense. The most dense, most expensively produced, they really grab your attention. Zappa's someone who can use those techniques to put a spanner in the works. He draws attention to the means of manipulation. Lisa Jardine, why don't we listen to Don't Eat the Yellow Snow? He then played 30 seconds of apostrophe. It's quite perverse of me doing this. In some ways, I should have tried to dig out the tape of this interview from Radio 3 and played that. After all, this is radio. On the other hand, parsing my transcription of this through my own voice now might have its own interest, or not. Write in and complain if you don't agree. Lisa Jardine, I believe you have a theory on those words. Out to lunch. It's infinite. Those theories can go on forever. And I think I've been proved in this. When I was over in Paris for the third international conference of Ease and Plastic Zappology, Pacôme Thiamant gave a talk there. He's published a book called Economie Eskimo, and I've been reading it, and he delves into the imagistic thought of apostrophe in a way which shows that reflection on this extraordinarily dense record of complete nonsense can go on forever. One of the things that the press seemed to like about my book was that many rather lame textual analyses of King Lear like to stress the recurrence of images of negativity, zero, nothing, emptiness, and you can look at the triviality of what Frank Zappa's doing in the same light, and in fact draw out many of the same conclusions. Then there was a silence. Right, says Lisa. The Shakespeare professor here is thrown. I think there were other sources. I was interested after reading your analysis. I listened to the lyrics and I thought we've definitely got a lot of closed O's and zeros there, and I would like to think they're in the same tradition. But Zappa himself is persistently flippant, which again makes him different from someone like David Byrne, who talks earnestly about his own aspirations in music. Your book is in dramatic contrast to this flippancy of Zappa himself. Did you have any difficulty with that? Even right at the end, when he was being filmed in the last stages of putting together his last word on music, he wouldn't speak seriously about it. Lunch. Zappa's very flippant about the status of his art, which I think a lot of people involved in, say, theatre could look at and learn from. I don't think he's flippant about the actual state of the world. He was one of the few pop people to speak out against the Gulf War. Here I was talking about the first Gulf War, when Bush Sr. was in charge. I mean, where was David Byrne when you needed him? Zappa spoke about the bombing of Iraq and how monstrous it was. The only other person was Ice-T. Zappa's serious about what he called those dealers in death sitting round a table in the afternoon at the Pentagon, figuring who they're going to blow up now, who they're going to subjugate. But he could also see, what is a pop record? What is going to the theatre? He had a kind of Zen nihilism about taking that seriously. Lisa, so you want us to keep listening to the records and acknowledging him, but without turning him, I hope, into some pedestalised guru? Lunch. Someone said in Modern Review, Matt Fitch, I think it was, that Zappa could become the bronze turd on the altar of the Church of Postmodernism. Maybe that's his ultimate role. Lisa, thank you, Ben Watson. Always keen to reduce art to personality. After all, if the real meaning of Zappa's records were our own responses, we could do without journalism's half-wit mediations. It was the encounter in the epilogue that caused most interest among the journalists. Assessments as to what actually happened were gratifyingly mismatched. According to the Sunday Times, the chance to meet his hero, the man he believes is the greatest artist of the late 20th century, knocks him right off his objective critical tightrope down into the hopeless whirling waters of fandom. However, the Independent on Sunday reached the opposite conclusion. It is to Watson's credit that when he actually gets to meet the object of his fascination, his critical principles do not go out of the window. Had the reviewers of the quality press been reading the same book? Such misunderstandings arise because the epilogue, which records my encounter with Frank Zappa himself, depicts an objective contradiction in the process of marketed art. Bourgeois categories, genius, art, eternity, can't accommodate the fact that subjectivity is coded, a concatenation of responses to external stimuli. Locked in an idealism deriving from Plato, newspaper common sense expects art appreciation to be a matter of the communing of souls, not a material exchange between agents concerned to fuck up journalism's world picture. Poodle coincidences did not stop with Frank's death. The project object continues to extrapolate conceptual continuity across the loop, despite the material absence of the author. Such popular, intercollective surrealist research is, of course, incomprehensible to the lackeys of the star system and hierarchical value. What then, according to these style journalists, is the style of the book? As self-contradicting as Mark Edwards, Andy Gill managed to press the poles into a single oxymoron. He said, "For the most part, though, Watson's style derives less from journalism than from the leftist-leaning branches of academia, being more in the polemical style of the pamphlet or broadsheet. Telos Journal or Socialist Worker? Surely this runs the gamut of styles. Record Collector magazine managed to combine the familiar self-indulgence brickbat with another piquant contradiction. On one level, the negative dialectics of Poodle Play could be taken as a hysterical piece of self-indulgence, the ravings of a man obsessed with the intricacies of his own bookshelves, or as one of the most stimulating assemblages of critique, polemic and surrealism ever collected between hard covers. It's hard to fathom what a non-self-indulgent attitude to culture should be. Put the nose to the grindstone and listen to Phil Collins? In The Wire, Dave Rimmer called it dense, intricate and rather wearying. An apologetic Rimmer, on the phone from Berlin a few weeks later, declared that it was deadline pressure that caused him to resent the book's difficulty. The need for every magazine under the sun to jump through every hoop simultaneously not only explains why everyone talks about the same excruciatingly dull crud all the time, it explains why nothing is engaged with, only described. Rimmer, who was an aspirant music hack during the punk rock against racism years, was still smarting from that brusque intrusion into his career space. He subsequently toured with Boy George. Politics were therefore his sticking point. My attempt to recruit Zappa to the anti-Nazi League was mocked as dreary piffle, deprived of great man kudos by a paraphrase that omitted a reference to its author. Walter Benjamin's definition of fascism provoked telling indignation. Rimmer said, "Zappa's work shines under this kind of erudite attention, which makes it all the more depressing to see Watson elsewhere descend into the pat language of political position. I'm sorry, Ben, but just to take one of many examples, a compromise between the masses' desire for change and respect for the laws of private property is about the most pathetic description of fascism I've heard." Rimmer was not to know that Walter Benjamin, who originally made the formulation of which that's a paraphrase, is about as welcome, or used to be. Times have changed. Walter Benjamin used to be about as welcome among the SWP hardcore as Trotskyists among the poetic community of trust around the Prinians. The splits in left culture, don't you love them? I have to report that the SWP is embracing Walter Benjamin far more than it ever did before. And it was the problem of being a pioneer in that particular argument that Benjamin's subjective Marxism could have relevance for revolutionary politics. It now seems to be far more admitted in that party than it was when this book was written, where they just wanted to send you away to reread Lukács and Leavis. Elsewhere in the same issue, Rimmer was to be found pontificating on spirituality and social change in an article about Berlin techno, So no doubt the cause for scandal was the absence of the expected liberal cant about evil, that creaky religious concept that prevents liberals from understanding fascism or doing anything about it. Next month, Ian Paterson was to be found pointing this out on the Wire's letters page. Interesting to note how, deprived of the obfuscating aura of the famous name, Walter Benjamin's ideas, someone claimed by the clever right as a mystic, condemned by the stupid left for the same reason, is suddenly a soulless, practical materialist. The daddy cool of Britpop softwashology, the godfather of the Popsicle Academy, Simon Frith, blamed the whole abortion on Frank. He said, "If it wasn't for Frank Zappa, Ben Watson's The Negative Dialectics of Poodle Play would undoubtedly be the best book on rock since John Savage's England's Dreaming." With the lordly, all-seeing gaze of the pop expert who presents the Mercury Awards on British television, pushing his limp palm at the latest examples of youth culture to turn a buck for entertainment capital, Simon Frith sketches a picture of life in the Chemic Tavern, Woodhouse. Watson captures brilliantly, if unwittingly, the world of the provincial British groupuscule, the eccentric intensity of those political pub conversations in which disagreements over who played bass on the bootleg version of Zappa's Dynamo Hum causes longer-term social rifts than arguments about the correct Trotskyist line on Bosnia. Frith, on the other hand, captures brilliantly, if unwittingly, the sad nostalgia of the middle-aged academic, not so much postmodern as ex-mod, forever sentimentalising the excitements of his youth, forever incapable of grasping that music need not be reduced to Top of the Pops. The modicum of social power granted someone who writes in the newspapers about pop releases gives him the gall to patronise anyone who might commit themselves to something so unsuccessful under capitalism as good music. Indeed, the creepy way he talks about rock bands is enough to give homosexuality and paedophilia a bad name. Frith says, "It does feel more convincing, more right, to have young men playing what was, after all, young men's music. I guess that sums up, really, why I haven't found Frank Zappa very interesting since, 1971. Tell that to Muddy Waters, Frith. Ah, those rosy cheeks and tight trousers. Like so many structural clichés, Zappa had already got the measure of this kind of pained postmarital acceptance of the limits of sexuality under capitalism. As he sips his claret in the privacy of his home and wonders why his friends don't ring him anymore, Simon Frith should take a long look at the cover of Zoot Allures. It was in the serious monthlies that Poodle Play most intriguingly tripped up on the fissures of the contemporary culture. In the Times Literary Supplement, Andrew Blake turned the book into a cheese wire designed to slice through contemporary Britain and expose its flaky inability to talk about music. It's so evident that the sheerly musical intelligence of Zappa is lost on educated people, content to mealy-mouth the socio-pleasantries of conformist lack of life, that Poodle Play felt proud to play the part of Blake's garrote. The gibbering anti-intellectualism of the rock industry yay-sayers likewise felt the arrows of Blakean scorn. Blake, though, as a conscientious doyen of contemporary cultural studs, had to diss Marxism qua narrative, emphasising instead the Freudian timelessness of the Zappa oeuvre. Poodle Play was polite enough to reply by letter. How can I square the timeless Freudian unconscious with a Marxist linear view of history? In some ways, I want to shrug off some of those dilemmas as postmodern angst. After all, it's only Pomo theory that sets up a doxa against narrative, the bogeyman. Deleuze and Guattari want to theorise the unconscious as timeless, but Freud has actually got a very strong sense of individual etiology, the development of the individual psyche. It's after the publication of his case histories, stories of people's development, that radical literature can start questioning the need for novels. There is undoubtedly something utopian and polymorphously perverse lurking behind Zappa's 360-degree satire, but he does not present it as an opportunity to jack off in the jacuzzi, the primordial froth of transcendent music from Debussy's La Mer to David Toop's Ocean of Sound. Zappa's utopia is firmly over on the listener's side of the fence. He gives me endless degradation, satire and critique. In response, I envisage a world without fear, but I image it myself, it's not painted for me. Compare the Torah's prohibition on images of God. It's true that Zappa's music proceeds via contrasted blocks rather than formal development. He isn't Conlon Nancarrow, but he's adept enough at harmonic logic to arrive at surprise. He learns from Nancarrow. Zappa makes you prick up your ears, listen to this sound here, rather than bask. His guitar solos are graphic in their linear logic. If they were timeless, you wouldn't imagine drawing them as a sequence of events. You'd kind of spray the room with an odour, like listening to Jerry Garcia. However, this doesn't prevent Zappa conceiving of his entire oeuvre as a simultaneously existing self-refracting crystal. Your Marxism is a narrative or it is nothing, it's just the conventional Pomo slur on Marx. Walter Benjamin saw the narrative Marxism of the Second International, its idea of slow, inevitable progress towards communism, as a betrayal of Marxism's revolutionary kernel. Trotsky and Lenin emphasised the revolutionary moment, bending the stick, breaking with the tradition of both society and the party. Post-structuralism's knowledge of Marx is bound by the Stalinism of Sartre and Althusser. In reacting against their travesty of Marx, the critique frequently emerges as right-wing rather than revolutionary. Back to Nietzsche. Marxism is indubitably historical, and unless you're willing to go insane, you can't deconstruct the history we're actually in. However, the fictions of narrative can be deconstructed. Hence the Pomo insistent that Marxism is just another narrative. Actually, what they mean is just another concept, which demonstrates their weak grasp of philosophy, the place of concepts in thought, etc. Back to Hegel, monsieur. So I don't find it a problem that Zappa should entertain the idea of simultaneity and engage politically. He trusts that utopia is there in your head, that infantile joy, that dada, is the basis of his disappointment with the contemporary world, the guiding light for his musical and political engagement. This radical subjectivity implies an egalitarianism contrary to the star system pieties of Sting and Springsteen. Zappa achieves a dialectic between timeless pleasure and historical action, not a stymied contradiction or a self-delusion. Hello, Mr. Cage. Perhaps the fact that Zappa doesn't deliver a representation of either, but enacts them, uses them to make things happen, is what causes confusion to people who think in either ors. Zappa's art refuses the options of a culture based on hierarchical separation. Having served for Blake as the quirt for swishing British musical philistinism, Poodle Play then became the bearskin run for Stephen Sweeney Turner's prostration before Susan McClary, New Musicology's Madonna-come-Thatcher figurine for kicking grey-beard professors in the balls. What excitement as bared body parts were frigged on surfaces that didn't ought to raise a wheel or rasher erogenous spots in bacon in Excelsis Rotterdam. 590 pages of Poodle Play were passed over in silence by Stephen Sweeney Turner in order to concentrate on the 10-page frisson provided by Poodle Play's McClary baiting. One felt like a whipped schoolboy. Yum. Why this inability to deal with 98% of the book? The truth is, neophyte theoreticians like Sweeney Turner can only talk to parrots who chirp their own jargon. Everything else in the rainforest is a mystery. Faced with Wild Man Fisher or Lisa Popeye, the man's a dead sausage. I mispronounced her name. It's so like this when you're keen on music and you learn names from buying records and seeing names and you aren't in the culture that speaks them. So I later found out I shouldn't say Lisa Popeye. That sounds like a really good name for me. I should say Lisa Popeil. As befits the ideal realm of speculation, where concepts are ambrosia for angels who've transcended the merely material, i.e. Zappa's music or the class society in which it's produced, the stumbling block was that point at which even the idea must have its somatic plunge. Sex. Poodle Play's deviation from Pomo's sexual orthodontry was cause for anguish, especially in its ungallant treatment of poor, defenceless maid McClary. Enter Goodnight Sweeney into the list, a strange-looking hero, abuzz with philosophy, but seemingly incapable of peering through his visor to see what's actually happening. He points out how, in writing about opera, McClary in fact revels in precisely the same kind of reversals and subversions which Watson identifies as crucial to his Poodle Play. As if Poodle Play had not already thoroughly applauded, for example, McClary's devastating sexual reductionist account of Beethoven's Ninth and Bizet's Carmen. To degrade the classics by reducing the sublime to a grunting phallic spurt is a procedure dear to Poodle Play. In his hurry to rush to the defence of McClary Dark, Night Sweeney forgets that Poodle Play has already done all that, but feels betrayed by her subsequent turns. According to Sweeney's blissful romance, McClary's support for current classical music orthodoxy, the fantasy of Steve Reich and Philip Glass as propagators of a new, unoppressive sexuality, doesn't at all imply an attack on atonality. even though the concrete situation is that minimalism has effectively provided a perfect excuse for classical programmers to ignore unpopular music. I'm concerned to look at what music is actually being played today and why, or more importantly, what is not and why not. Sweeney Turner is outraged that Poodle Play has the temerity to point out that McClary sells out her own musicology, dumps her own insightful logic in favour of the musical status quo. Lacking a concept of the social limits on critical thought, of how political economy, of which Poodle Play admits it's a mere echo, became the rationalising soft soap lackey of the bourgeoisie, Sweeney Turner cannot do more than recommend the feminist musicology is currently plagiarising in order to pose as the radical new thing in the pages of the Musical Times. He certainly can't point at any music going on that is worth its salt. That's my ultimate test of a music writer. Sweeney Turner says, I keep wanting to call him Sweeney Todd. More seriously, one could ask what connection exists between Watson's assertion of climatic closure and his guru Adorno's arguments against the closure of synthesis. Unwittingly, Sweeney Turner provides here a perfect sample of the idiocies produced by those whose object of study is concepts rather than the thing conceived. Poodle Play protests McClary's politically correct doxa against climactic music by reference to Commoner Garden's sexual experience, which, in my experience, has always been climactic. It interprets McClary's right-on bullshit as the blandishment of repressive authority over tongue-tied sophomores in an American music college. In another realm, Poodle Play's Adornoite hostility to philosophical synthesis is a protest against the idea that mere thought can solve the problems of the world. Where's the contradiction? In the ludicrous idea that the concept of closure or not closure is some kind of political standpoint. When it's cold, I close doors. When it's hot, I don't. Where is the switch? In the weather, not in my door-closing philosophy. Crusaders of the spirit will be with us as long as capitalism rewards words with money and bullshit with university stipends. But seldom can they appear quite as quixotic as in the cavorts of Cavalier Sweeney Turner. The tight wicker basket of the music press was not the only place for Poodle Play. The sordid backyards of literature beckoned. In London Review of Books, one-time poet Ian Sinclair wrote a stunning tranche of prose. Here is a man not to be intimidated by charges of self-indulgence. His prose left you thinking what a great writer he was and what a lunatic thing Poodle Play must be. The idea of an Allen Ginsberg groupie becoming a second-hand book dealer is only bizarre to record-obsessed hipsters out in the provinces. To denizens of Camden Town's compendium bookshop, it's par for the course. The threat of Sinclair's hallucinogenic prose, a noisome miscegenation of Burroughs, Prynne, Private Eye, Tristan Tzara and Harrison Birtwistle being detonated anywhere within personal proximity is terrifying. However, when the shrapnel had been extracted from the soft parts of the arm and the dust had blown away into the medical sky, it was possible to view Sinclair's rhapsody in another light. For once, I couldn't be browbeaten with accounts of life levels I'd not experienced. Sinclair is a beat, even if he's not a wanker. This was me, portrayed with a 360-degree flare, or, peeping over the tenements, a conical oilskin alp, way out beyond the defensive patronism of frithbabble. How does it feel to be portrayed by the most virulent prose meister in Anglo letters since Wyndham Lewis? I quote, "It's a breeze for Watson to present himself as a schizoid high-culture virtuoso who is dedicating years of his life, risking his equilibrium on a diet of special brew and pirate tapes, to calibrating the minutiae of Frank Vincent Zappa's monstrous oeuvre. The ghost of Zappa," quotes, I've never read any philosophy at all, "will bless this tall, invertebrate figure." Invertebrate? I've got a backbone, man. Anyway, that's what he says. "Will bless this tall, invertebrate figure, spectacles and ironic coke spoon around his neck, who conjures up Aldous Huxley, another English intellectual who went AWOL in the Californian desert." Well, conjures up Aldous Huxley in your strange brain, Ian. The impact of Sinclair's conceits, the Illuminati, have been smuggled into the index. A permanent mimosa-scented tutorial. A pale blue pamphlet so aerial that it lay on the palm of his hand like a wafer of light. The impact of these images is unnerving. One's life seems more vivid in his words than in one's own memory. But Sinclair's point of view is partial. Intoxicated with the flex-whip sizzle of his images, he can only conceive art as a scam, flogging outre experience to the sedentary classes. obsessively visual, he's deaf to the one argument about Zappa that is irrefutable, his music. Sinclair says, "But is Zappa worth all this scrupulous attention? Who cares? Biography is autobiography and drag." Cynicism born of years of book dealing ends up with political gaffes like smarming Jeffrey Archer. At least he made his own dosh. But it also provides a materialist deflatus for bourgeois hush-puppery about the artistic experience. The tabloid fantasy that leftist Cambridge poetry comes from the same impulse of treachery as the spying of Anthony Blunt evinces Sinclair's complete ignorance of the facts of left politics. But independence from academico-Marxist twaddle does allow him to talk convincingly of the possibility of proletarian realism. Still better, his window in London Review of Books allowed him to air the latest from J.H. Prynne, another this is another little mouth poem to entertain you while you're scratching your head about the other stuff. Another necessarily egregious eyeball in this restaging of the Lewis Joyce wars. Later on, the not notably socialist, to quote Sinclair, Peter Ackroyd, cemented London Review of Books' support for Poodle Play by making it one of his choices at Christmas. Thank you, Peter. While the doyen of institutionalised Marxist lit crit, Terry Eagleton, studiously avoided it. Was Poodle Play redrawing the battle lines or falling between every available stool in a scatological shower? The New Statesman summoned up the traditional forces of the counterculture to do battle with Poodle Play, and it was in the shape of Charles Shaw Murray, one-time friend of Gamma. He objected to being substantially misrepresented, but didn't explain how, instead treating us to some of that alarmingly active prose that the enemy can no longer manage. Charles Shaw Murray said, "A 600-page, 200,000-word monstrosity riddled with feet note and packaged with a debonair poodle bearing a startling resemblance to Mr. Ron Wood of the Rolling Stones rhythm and blues combo." Sticking to his no-nonsense notion of musical militancy, which later allowed him to support punk, CSM will not tolerate the use of objectionable Zappa material in the surrealist alchemy, but he nevertheless drew a righteous conclusion. Watson makes one first-rate political point, that Zappa's music annihilates class-based categories of consumption. By juxtaposing and superimposing high art devices adapted from avant-garde concert music with locker room humour and driving rhythm and blues, he forces all but the most eclectic listener to confront something unfamiliar. However, he pointed out, only Zappa fans will read it. Like a dementia-seeking missile, great phrase, Charlie, it will pursue hardcore Zappa files wherever they hide. However, they can console themselves with the thought that, while they may be twisted enough to read a book like this, at least they weren't twisted enough to write it. Civilians, on the other hand, will find it all as utterly impenetrable as lumpy gravy. Such tidy disposal of Poodle Play's mess on the carpet, it's a monstrosity, but only Zappa fans will read it, and they're outnumbered anyway, was also the gist of Mark Sinker's appraisal in Red Pepper. Sinker, an anti-Marxist and self-styled postmodernist who used to walk around with a copy of Grammatology in his pocket, once wrote for Marxism Today before it did the decent thing and committed harakiri. People who got beyond Marx could suddenly wake up to the beauties of being published by the bourgeois press. Red Pepper wanted him to sort out this threat from the hard left. Postmodernists have a hard time with Poodle Play, because it appears to give them what they want, a free range over cultural life that trashes niche marketing and class barriers, class conceived by bourgeois sociology, may it be said, but stomps their wish-fulfilling fantasies into the ground with Leninist politics. Sweeney Turner tried to align Adornoite negative dialectics with Derridean deconstruction, as if Derrida's narcissistic waffle could ever get to grips with a musical object. Wonder what Ed Baxter thinks about that phrase, he still being quite a Derrida fan. While Sinker welcomed Poodle Play's attempts to find common ground in our balkanised culture. But since class war, not the homogenised market of laissez-faire liberalism, is the aim of Poodle Play, Sinker's rapprochement was bound to be problematic. Sinker's particular flavour of postmodernism is idiosyncratic, reflecting his own background in maths, and it's really good old British empiricism, Parisian theory, a smokescreen to fend off Marxist critique. Sinker said, "The postmodernist model might be the way scientists classify nature. Highly concentrated local empiricism is constantly used to question the grand theory of the moment. There has to be a grand theory. It's the only way you can come up with a method of classification. This is what every science undergraduate who does a theory course is taught. Thomas Kuhn's epistemological paradigms, Karl Popper's open society. According to Sinker, Poodleplay's understanding of Adorno's modernism is wonky. A maggoty mix of speculation, desecration, puns, upendings and inside outings. These interpretations are so delirious that they threaten to undermine Freud and Marx, the two monoliths to intellectual respectability and received misconception the book is ostensibly bracketed with. The problem is that Sinker took his Marx and Freud on trust, from the spoiled brat plaints of Jean Baudrillard and Gilles Deleuze, rather than by plugging into the electricity of the actual texts. He seems unaware that Poodleplay seeks to slough off the accretions of academic Stalinized Marxism and institutionalized psychoanalysis, a return to the revolutionary kernel of their thought. Sinker's empiricism credits a world of appearances. Gray Hobsbawm as some kind of preeminent Marxist, when in fact he's a Stalinized liberal. Freud as a grey bearded professor, when actually he's a sexual revolutionary. He even notes with amazement that Poodleplay is so much more open than Hobsbawm on jazz, as if all self-professing Marxists belong to the same club. For Sinker, Marxism is a grim grey cloud that rains on thought, not an analysis of bars on the window that are all too real. Half-cock philosophy must depend on prohibitions and slogans. It can't entertain concepts and let them unfurl according to their own dynamic. So Sinker says, Watson even uses that giveaway phrase, bourgeois science. No doubt science students are told that anyone who questions scientific reason must be a mystic or a totalitarian, the straw man of Lysenko fed to the Bunsen burner. But is Poodleplay really a Stalinist textbook with A, biblical exegesis of Marx, and B, provisos as to the results of experiments? Only two sentences in Poodleplay even get close to the taboo phrase, bourgeois science. One is, like many artists faced with the impersonal world picture of bourgeois natural science, Zappa has invented a private system of references, a language in whose articulation he can play a more active role. That's one use. The other use was, Zappa shows an acute grasp of the illusory nature of scientific certainty in a society based on war. He asks, will it explode? And the profit motive, will this affect real estate values? Like David Ocker's sleeve note to Francesco Zappa, which questioned the idea of transcendent value in Baroque music by pointing out that it was produced to accompany bewigged aristocrats while they dined, this kind of thinking is extremely subversive. Its materialism goes beyond bourgeois faith in science and seeks to understand its roots in the requirements of social forces. Sinker can quell his undergraduate fears. The characterization of science as bourgeois isn't being made in order to usher in a politically correct communist or proletarian science, as Sinker somewhat sneakily implies. If Sinker bothered to attend any SWP meetings on science and culture, he'd learn that the Trotskyist tradition damns such attempts at direction by the party as redolent of prolet cult Stalinism. However, that isn't to say that Marxism can't see beyond the horizon of natural science positivism. Historical understanding questions the eternal nature of scientific discoveries. Natural science was a product of a rising bourgeoisie. It's currently the ideology of ruling classes that threaten the extinction of the world through nuclear and ecological disaster. If we can't critique that, then we're all down the pan. And you thought Red Pepper was launched as a socialist paper, Mr. Pinter. Never underestimate the mépris of the fanzine editor. Secure in his blinkered omnipotence, Fred Tomzet, big cheese of Tamershi Dween, could hardly contain his rage at the existence of Poodleplay. It was worth all the work just to see him jump. Fred said, most of what Adorno says has little to do with Zappa. The books he chooses are sure to be works Zappa won't have read. The idea that Zappa managed to get through Finnegan's Wake, not expressed in the book, but if that isn't the implication, then wild the cross-references make me howl with laughter. Maybe Fred did get the point after all. Tamershi Dween, number 40, printed a parody of Poodleplay, The Mop as Fish in a Coma, out and away the best thing the magazine has ever carried. As the pseudonymous author sought to mimic Poodleplay's ever-unpopular connectivitis, genuine poetry emerged, useful and evocative idea-fish escaping the dull nets of fanzine hero-ship. In another issue, the benign effects of the book were registered by someone who declared he had no intention of reading Poodleplay. This was a comment made. Arnold Schwarzenegger's endorsement of George Bush in the 1992 presidential election is presaged in Adorno's essay Culture Industry Reconsidered. He said, "Human dependence and servitude, the vanishing point of the culture industry, could scarcely be more faithfully depicted than by the American interviewee who was of the opinion that the dilemma of the contemporary epoch would end if people would simply follow the lead of prominent personalities." Makes you think, Adorno, doesn't it? I mean,